welcome to my channel, Anglican Aesthetics. I'm excited about this video. It's based off of a presentation I gave in Minneapolis, and it's part of my catechetical lecture series that I'm building for my church, for people who are just interested in exploring Anglican theology. And it's my first scripted video, so I'm going to try this to see if I can sort of maximize efficiency here. This video will be on the beauty of the Trinity. Now, the Trinity is the beating heart of all reality. God is the eternal three-in-one in whom all beauty, bliss, and goodness is found, and from whom all transcendentals radiate into creation. Beauty, goodness, and truth are the echoes of the excellencies of God's nature, the triune God's nature in creation. So in this video, I want to unpack the dynamic beauty of the Trinity, showing how the glory of the triune God colors all of life. I want to start by thinking about love. Now, love is sort of what makes life worth living, right? So why do we befriend people at all? Hopefully, you don't seek friendship in order to get something, like a warm meal. Hopefully, you're not making friends so that they can cook you dinner. But rather, you order the goods of your life to spend time with friends, spouses, families, people. Love is this dynamic back and forth gift in which being is poured into being. It is this free gift in which people mutually give themselves to each other in order to mutually enrich each other. And that's sort of the shape of all reality, right? So if you think about trees, trees take in oxygen and turn it, or rather take in carbon dioxide and turn it into oxygen. They take in nutrients and produce fruit. You take in things from your exterior environment and yield works of your hand. There's a sort of back and forth shape that all of reality has, such that all of creation is this symphony of interlinking things which mutually build each other up. As Christians, we think that this is so because creation echoes the shape of triune living love, which is the heart of all reality. So, what is this mystery that we call the Trinity? Now, I've made a video about this. I'll link that in the comments below that covers some of the biblical basis for this and covers some of this as well. But I wanted to sort of capture this and focus on the Trinity's relationship to beauty in this video. But first, let's start with a basic definition. Again, you can find that in my prior video. The doctrine of the Trinity teaches that God is one in being and three in person. So let's define those a little bit more closely. Being, roughly speaking, refers to whatness, whereas person, roughly speaking, refers to who-ness. So we're going to nuance those terms just a little bit. But you can sort of think about this in light of the question. If someone asks you, what are you? You'd say, I'm a human being. Someone asks me who I am, I'd say, Sean. Now, you and I, we're the same kind of being. We're both human, but we're not the same being. Whereas you and I are also two whos. We're different persons. Now, in the life of God, what we want to say is not that the three persons are the same kind of being. Rather, the three persons, while distinct persons, are one in being. So whereas you and I are two beings and two persons, God is three persons in one being. So this isn't a contradiction, because we're not saying that there are three persons in one person or three beings in one being, but rather there are three persons who are fully the one divine essence, the one divine being. Okay, so if you haven't watched the St. Patrick's Bad Analogies video put out by Lutheran Satire, I encourage you to do that. I'm going to link it below. So if you haven't, pause it, watch it, pause this video. Okay, but now, assuming that video, let's dive a little bit deeper. So we want to say that each person is truly and wholly God, yet distinct from each other. So in the traditional language, that means that each person is a subsistence of the divine nature. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, imagine, if you will, a line segment from A to B. Okay. Now, that line segment AB conceptually can run the other way, from B to A. Now, technically and geometrically, this line segment AB and BA are the same line segment. But conceptually, what this does for us is that we can conceive of them in different ways. So insofar as you draw AB, there exists within the same movement a movement from B to A, conceptually. So this gives us a sort of conceptual handle on what it could mean to say that the persons are ways that the divine essence is. In other words, they are co-eternal modes of being. So this isn't modalism, because we're not saying that God puts on his father face and then puts on his son face, but rather the persons are what we call personal modifications or modes of divine being. Okay, so let's dive into this a little bit. So what we want to say is that the Father is the one single divine nature in the mode of paternity. The Son is the one single divine nature in the mode of filiation or begottenness. And the Spirit is the divine nature in the mode of spiration. So when we say that the Father is the divine nature in the mode of paternity, what we mean is that the Father is the one who gives all that he is to the Son. To be a father is to assume a son, and so if the Father was the Father eternally, that means he eternally begot or begets the Son. That is to say that the Father is deity given to the Son. So the Father is the mode of deity, of deity given to, of deity given towards, or deity pouring itself out to another. And so there's a directionality of from one to another, which is the Father. And that's what it means to confess that the Father eternally begets or eternally generates the Son. The Son, to be eternally begotten, just means in the Godhead that he is from the Father. In other words, the Son is the mode of deity back to and from, or sorry, back or from and to the Father. So the Son is the movement of deity, which receives, or is rather back to the Father. He is the mode who, as the mirror of the Father, gives his deity back to the Father. So the Father gives himself in full to the Son, and the Son, eternally having received his deity from the Father, returns that. And so there is this co-eternal movement in which the Father gives all that he is to the Son, and the Son returns all that he is to the Father. And this movement never had a beginning, but was co-eternal, coexistent. So whence the Holy Spirit? The Spirit in this movement is the mode of deity in which the Father gives himself to the Son, and the Son returns himself to the Father. In other words, the Spirit is deity to and from. So if we sort of plot this along on our conceptual line segment, right, you can sort of think it from A to B, okay, that first movement, quote-unquote first, well, first in the procession of persons, is the Father. That movement from B to A, back from B to A, is the Son. And the Spirit is, as it were, the movement from A to B and B to A. So the self-same line segment sort of conceived in different ways, but now the persons, the difference and the key difference, and this is where the analogy of course breaks down, is that the persons aren't merely conceptual differences in the Trinity, but rather the persons are ways, co-eternal ways, in which the one divine nature subsists. And the Spirit is the one in whom the Father gives himself to the Son, and in whom the Son returns himself to the Father, and in this way proceeds from the Father through the Son as their bond of love. So briefly, how do we get this from Scripture? Okay, so Hebrews 1:3, this is where eternal generation is critiqued all the time and really unjustly. You often hear in sort of New Testament scholarship that, well, it has no biblical basis. I think that's false. And I'm going to argue that here. So Hebrews 1:3, we're told that the Son is the imprint of the Father's nature and the radiance of his glory. Think about the imagery of radiance. Radiance is something that shoots out from the thing radiating. That's an image of begetting. That's what we mean by begetting, right? The Son is also called the Word of the Father in John 1:1-18. Now, Jonathan Edwards gives what's been a helpful analog for me in thinking about this. Hopefully it's helpful to you as well. And he writes the following. If a man could have an absolutely perfect idea of all that passed through in his mind, all the series of ideas and exercises in every respect, perfect as to order, degree, circumstance, etc., for the last hour, he would really, to all intents and purposes, be over again what he was in that last hour. And if it were possible for a man, by reflexive thought, by a perfect reflexive thought, to contemplate all that is in his own mind in an hour, as it is, and at the same time, that is there in its first and direct existence, a man would really be two during that time. He would indeed be double. Okay, so let's unpack what Edwards means here. Consider what you ate for breakfast yesterday. Now consider the sensations and circumstances as best as you can, and relive that memory of you eating your breakfast. Edwards' point is that if you could do this perfectly, such that you could recall the total contents of consciousness, so not merely passive awareness, but you could recall the entire memory while also keeping perfect awareness of your surroundings here, in your consciousness, there would be two sort of inflections. There would be in your conscious experience the reliving of what you were in the past hour and your perfect presence in this present moment. So memory is this kind of faint echo of the Trinity in the human mind. So applied to the triune God, here's what we might say. The Father eternally contemplates supreme value. That is to say, he contemplates as the God who is good, right? The fount of goodness. He contemplates all that is beautiful, good, lovely, and excellent. But since the divine essence just is the font of the beautiful, the good, and the excellency of all being, the Father contemplates himself. In other words, when the Father contemplates that which is excellent, that which is lovely, that which is good, he is just contemplating his own nature as the paradigm of all that is good, all that is beautiful, all that is lovely. And so when the Father contemplates all that is good, all that is lovely, all that is perfect, he is in that moment forming a perfect idea of the divine excellencies. And the claim is that the Word, the Logos, is the Father's self-contemplation of the excellencies of divine nature. So just as one might speak to themselves in their mind, so the Father's thought recapitulates all excellencies to himself. And in this way, the Son is the Father's grasp of value, or the Father's self-utterance, the divine Word, the infinite evidence or infinite content of the excellency of divine being. So in this way, insofar as the Father contemplates all that is good eternally, all that is lovely, and therefore always gazes at the Son, who is the Father's eternal self-contemplation, he is the first movement of deity and therefore the principle, as the tradition affirms, of the divine essence. He is the divine essence in subsisting towards the Son. Now, Edwards' model here, it's often been critiqued for an infinite regress problem, right? If the Father contemplates himself, then that generates the Son. Well, what happens when the Son contemplates himself? Wouldn't that generate a third? Oh, well, that's the Spirit. Okay, well, what if the Spirit contemplates himself, and a fourth and a fifth ad infinitum, right? Here's how I think we can answer that objection. The Son is the mirror of the Father. and the exact imprint of his nature. And so as the Father contemplates himself in the Son contemplates himself in the Father. In other words, because there is, quote unquote, already one who is the radiance, who is the perfect sort of correspondent to the Son's divine excellencies, namely the Father, the Son need only look back to the Father, and in this way he mirrors the Father. The Son is the one who gives himself back in love. And he gives himself back precisely because he is begotten, and thus is the image of the begetter. Now, we can refine this idea more carefully to capture the function of the circumcession of the persons, that is, their mutual indwelling. Lest the Father and Son are conceived as pure gift givers without any hope of return. So when the Father contemplates supreme value, his perfect idea of himself, this idea, if it is truly perfect, contains a view of God's own self-contemplation. So the Father contemplates himself in the Son, and in the Son sees a sort of image of the Father's self-contemplation, which is the Father's gaze back to the Son. And so when the Father sees himself in the Son, he sees also the Son's self-return to the Father. And the Spirit then, as I've suggested, is the movement of deity from the Father to the Son and from the Son back to the Father. Lawrence Feingold, in a really excellent book, puts it this way. The Son comes forth from the Father as his word uttered. The Word then breathes forth love for the Father, giving himself back to him. And the Father, likewise, by the same perfect impetus, gives himself to the Son. The Spirit proceeds thus, from the mutual and eternal self-gift of the Son to the Father, and the Father to the Son. Thus the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son as the bond of unity. The filioque is not just an abstruse point of theological speculation, but something that is existentially vital. If the Spirit proceeds from a love that is agape, how could that love be one-sided? So in other words, when the Father gazes at the Son, he sees in the Son an assuredness of the Son's self-return. And this mutual seeing is the Spirit. Or this, the one, the bond in which the Father gives himself to the Son and the Son returns himself to the Father is the Holy Spirit. Okay. So in this way, the Spirit has been conceived kind of analogically as an internal impulse in deity of movement towards, by a movement towards, wherein the persons are moving towards each other, by which love proceeds and which is holy God, since the Holy Spirit is a subsistence of the whole divine essence. As we learn from the economy that the Spirit rests on the Son from the Father and also is sent by the Son, insofar as the economy is fitting because it reflects the eternal processions, the Spirit is therefore the one in whom the Father and Son are made known. Just as that conceptual line segment, remember, ABA, it may go from A to B and then from B back to A, while both being numerically identical with that one sort of thing, that one line segment. In this sort of way, in this sort of conceptual, that conceptual analog gives us a handle, a kind of conceptual handle, by which to think about the fact that the Spirit is really the divine essence and the eternal back and forth of love. So the Father, in this way, begets the Son in the Spirit, and the Son filially returns himself to the Father in that self-same Spirit. Okay, so really wonderful mysteries there. There's something deeply mysterious, deeply beautiful about this. But why does this matter? So in the next few videos, in this video, I'm going to unpack one way, and I'm going to unpack three ways in total in three videos, and two more videos after this. But first, I want to say that the Trinity reshapes our experience of beauty. In the next video, I'm going to argue that the Trinity grounds the primacy of love in human experience. And then third, I'm going to argue that the Trinity reframes what it means to be saved. I'll just focus on the Trinity's relationship to our experience of beauty. So to do this, I want to read you a chapter of a book I had been writing, which was rejected by publishers. But I thought I reworked it a little bit, and I thought this actually could make a good script. So these are features of beauty, which I think will fit well if beauty is ultimately an echo of God's triune life. Here's what I want to submit. That beauty is the gravitas of love. And gravitas, I mean in the old Latin sense of the word, which was used by Cicero, right? So gravity of love, but gravitas by Cicero was this idea of this weighty sort of impression. You have gravitas. You walk into a room and then all eyes are on you, right? So there's this sense of weightiness which draws things to itself. Beauty, I want to suggest, is the impression of the dynamics of triune love which draw things to itself and is experienced as the delight of love. So the what it feels like to be in the pull of beauty, you know, so if you were sort of cruising by a black hole and you were being pulled into that black hole, gravity at that point feels like something. So what it feels like to be in the orbit of beauty is love on the human soul. So why do people cry when they're looking at the stars? Why do people propose in front of a sunset? I want to argue it's because that is a context of love. Beauty is the impression of triune love in creaturely reality. Okay, so here are some features that I think fit with this account. So this account isn't necessarily proven by these features, but I think it fits very, very well. First, beauty has this gratuitous ultimacy. And here's what I mean. Beauty is sought for its own sake. So whereas I might build a bookshelf in my apartment to house books or work for a paycheck to provide for my family, I don't look at a painting in order to obtain some other necessity for my life. Snowflakes, music, poetry, and the canvas of an autumn forest are all delights for their own sake. A star-speckled sky greeting our world on a cold winter night summons the courage to stand out in the cold and look up. Even while cold gnaws at the bone, I rush to greet heaven's nightly greeting for no other reason than that it is lovely in itself. The world's abundant with these kinds of joys. One of my favorite quotes from Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, reads as follows. And this is from his essays, the great classic series of essays he's written. We've crept out of our close and crowded houses into the night and morning, and we see what majestic beauties daily wrap us in their bosom. How willingly we would escape the barriers which render them comparatively impotent, escape the sophistication and second thought, and suffer nature to entrance us. The tempered light of the woods is like a perpetual morning and is stimulating and heroic. Who hasn't felt the joy of seeing the sun dancing on the edge of the horizon with golden fanfare spread across the sky right before it hides under the cover of night? That's a joy sought for its own sake. No one looks at that to fill their bellies, but you do look at it to fill your soul. The experience of joy strikes us as a gift. When I squint my eyes to see the patterns of snowflakes on a glass window, I feel profoundly grateful to be alive. The laugh of a young mother with her child evokes the sense it is good to be alive. Beauty comes to the soul as a fireplace in winter, providing the kind of warmth and satisfaction that makes us feel us at home. It is as though light dancing on the earth is, as it were, an echo of a dance to which we are graciously invited. The gratuity of beauty is therefore twofold. It is sought for its own sake, and is somehow given and experienced as a gift which evokes gratitude. Feature number two. Beauty is gratuitously, generatively diffusive. It is generatively diffusive. Okay, so Beauty begets and animates life beyond its initial appearance in our midst. So the jewels of the night sky, they generate things. They generate things like poems, songs, and sheer wonders, which then generate more beauty by itself and by its very encounter. So in the Phaedrus, Plato notices this. Plato argues through Socrates that a true lover, is a lover of beauty who has been possessed by a kind of madness, which springs from being reminded of true beauty from beauty of on earth. So the one initiated into this kind of madness starts to reverence the beloved as though he were a god. The sight of beauty prompts a kind of ascent of the soul, the growth of wings for Plato, which moves the lover closer to the beloved. The sight of beauty inflames the soul and is poured into the soul, moving the lover towards union with the beloved from the sight of beauty. Thus the lover loves the beloved on account of a striking resemblance to the beautiful. The love of beauty leads to a union which produces offspring, either natural offspring when the object is a beloved person, or offspring of thought when the object is of the more intellectual sort. So for instance, you can walk through a forest and the beauty of the forest impresses itself on your heart and you write poetry. You might seek inspiration from looking out on an ocean for something. Elaine Scarry, in her excellent book on beauty and being just, writes the following. Beauty brings copies of itself into being and makes us draw it, take photographs of it, or describe it to other people. Sometimes it gives rise to exact replication and other times to resemblances, and still other times to those things whose connection to the original site of inspiration is unrecognizable. A beautiful face drawn by Verrocchio suddenly glides into the perceptual field of a young boy named Leonardo. The boy copies the face, then copies the face again, then again and again and again. He does the same thing when a beautiful living plant, a violet wild rose, glides into his field of vision, or a living face. He makes a first copy, a second copy, a third, a fourth, a fifth. He draws it over and over. Just as Potter, who tells all of us this about Leonardo, replicates now in sentences Leonardo's acts, so that the essay reenacts its subject, becoming a sequence of faces, an angel, a Medusa, a woman, a child, a Madonna, John the Baptist, St. Anne. Before long, the means are found to replicate thousands of times over both the sentences and the faces, so that traces of Potter's paragraphs and Leonardo's drawings inhabit all the pockets of the world as pieces of them float in the paragraph now before you. As Emerson says, the beauty of nature reforms itself in the mind, and not for barren contemplation, but for new creation. So we've covered these two features so far. Beauty is this gratuitous gift. The encounter with beauty makes you feel as though you've been given a gift. It's sought for its own sake, and it's generatively diffusive. This fits, I think, if beauty is sort of the impression of triune love in things, because triune love is characterized by gratuitous self-gift. What is the procession of persons other than the gratuitous self-gift of the Father to the Son and from the Son back to the Father in the bond of love of the Spirit? It is the circulation of gift. And it's gratuitous, and it's ultimate in the sense that the Trinity, the triune love of God, is sought for its own sake, as love is sought for its own sake. And it's diffusive, right? So the Father eternally generates the Son. The Son, in the bond of love, returns himself to the Father, and this self-return is the one through whom, or that through which, the Spirit proceeds. So there's a fit between the generative diffusiveness of beauty, which was noticed by Elaine Scarry, by Plato. It's actually also noticed in Plotinus as well. That fits well with the character of a triune god. Feature number three, beauty is the fuel of true hope. So when we create towards new creation, We are, in fact, stretching ourselves towards a world which we have glimpsed in the advent of beauty. So this beatific stretching, this stretching oneself towards a vision of the future which you deem beautiful, I think is at the core of hope. Francis Pieper, in his book on hope, argues that true hope exists in the tension between magnanimity, the aspiration towards greatness, and humility, the sort of humble recognition of my own finitude in stretching towards greatness. I can't bring it about. So true hope, rather than sheer wishful thinking or optimism, springs from the sight of wondrous possibilities within the humble recognition of one's own finitude and their conditions in the world. I don't hope to be an omniscient deity, given the glimpse of my finitude. I don't hope to have wings either, right? Given an apprehension of my own nature as a human being. And yet I hope to kiss my wife when I get home, right, from work. Hope, true hope and not vain fantasy, flows from the imagination's vision of some beautiful sight, which is realizable in the world. Beauty often breaks into our experience as the bearer of new and powerful possibilities for the world. So I want to read you this poem by William Wordsworth, which I think captured this pretty well. It's called She Was a Phantom of Delight. So, she was a phantom of delight when first she gleamed upon my sight, a lovely apparition sent to be a moment's ornament, her eyes as stars of twilight fair, like twilight's too, her dusky hair, but all things else about her drawn from Maytime and the cheerful dawn, a dancing shape, an image gay to haunt, to start and waylay. I saw her upon nearer view, a spirit, yet a woman too, her household motions light and free, and steps of virgin liberty, a countenance in which did meet sweet records, promises as sweet, a creature not too bright or good for human nature's daily food, for transient sorrows, simple wiles, praise, blame, love, kisses, tears, and smiles. And now I see with eye serene the very pulse of the machine, a being breathing thoughtful breath, a traveler between life and death. The reason firm, the temperate will, endurance, foresight, strength, and skill, a perfect woman, nobly planned, to warm, to comfort, and command, and yet a spirit still and bright with something of angelic light. Okay, so the woman in the poet's sight is this embodiment of the very selfsame melody that rings in twilight's hues. That's why it coordinates the two. All things about her draw from the cheerful dawn, as though her beauty were the tiding of a new day. In her, the poet sees the possibility of human nature's daily food, shared smiles, laughs, tears, joys, praises, a life together. The hope-inducing of power of beauty is not limited to romance. I want to read you part of another poem in the fifth and sixth stanzas of his Hymn to Intellectual Beauty. Percy Shelley writes the following. Now, quick note, intellectual beauty is not sort of just cognitive beauty up here. It draws from Plotinus, who sees intellectual beauty as sort of the true beauty that shines in all beauty, the true beauty that the intellect perceives in every single instance of beauty. Okay, so Shelley writes the following. While yet a boy, I sought for ghosts and sped through many a listening chamber, cave and ruin, and starlight wood, with fearful steps pursuing hopes of high talk with the departed dead. I called on poisonous names which our youth is fed. I was not heard, I saw them not. When musing deeply on the lot of life, at that sweet time when winds are wooing all vital things that wake to bring news of birds and blossoming, sudden thy shadow fell on me. I shirked and clasped my hands in ecstasy. I vowed that I would dedicate my powers to thee and thine. Have I not kept my vow? With beating heart and streaming eyes, even now I call the phantoms of a thousand hours, each from his voiceless grave, They have envisioned powers of studious zeal or love's delight. Outwatched with me the envious might, they knew that never joy illumined my brow, unlinked with hope that thou wouldst free this world from its dark slavery. That thou, O awful loveliness, wouldst give whatever these words cannot express. It's one of my favorite poems. So the poet, having failed to connect with the spirit of the dead, awakens to beauty via the first stirrings of spring. When new birds and blossoming arrives, the shadow of pure beauty falls on him and induces sheer ecstasy. He then dedicates his life to the proclamation of beauty, with hope that beauty would free this world from its dark slavery. The vision of a world under the shadow of beauty's pure light animates the poet's entire life pursuits. So beauty gives us a glimpse into a world that might be in the midst of a world that is. Beauty inspires and fuels hope. Okay, so feature four. Well, let me back up. So think about how that corresponds to the Trinity, right? So if beauty really is the impression of triune love, then the reason why it inspires hope would be because in the glimpse of beauty, we taste that last end for which we were made. We taste, as it were, a promise of the way the world could be, a world suffused with the glory of our last end, the love that is at the heart of all reality, the triune God. So beauty induces hope, because the one whom all our hearts hope for, whether we know it or not, is the one appearing in beauty, is the one whose gravitas is emanating in the experience of the beautiful. Okay, so feature four. Beauty is the medicine for the wounded soul. Think about the experience of trauma. Trauma can darken the heart. It can fracture your sense of self. The world often loses any sense of stability in trauma. So Timothy Patitsis is an Orthodox priest who works with combat veterans, and he writes the following. Trauma results from a very powerful encounter with ugliness, especially if that ugliness strikes us as a kind of revelation, disclosing to us the real truth about the world. So think about Elie Wiesel. This paragraph in his book, Night, has stuck with me. It's a very powerful paragraph. He sees a child being hung, and he writes the following. He was a survivor of Auschwitz, of a concentration camp. He writes the following. But the third rope was still moving. The child, too light, was still breathing. So he remained for more than half an hour, lingering between life and death, writhing before our eyes. And we were forced to look at him at close range. He was still alive when I passed him. His tongue was still red, his eyes not yet extinguished. Behind me, I heard the same man asking, "For God's sake, where is God?" And from within me, I heard a voice answer, "Where is he? This is where, hanging here from this gallows." And from that moment, Wiesel found the God proclaimed in Rosh Hashanah was undeserving of praise and thanksgiving, became an atheist. We'll return to the problem of evil in a different video, but for now, it's important to note how trauma shapes the lens through which Wiesel saw the world. The world felt God-forsaken in the experience of trauma, and so disclosed the real truth, quote-unquote, about the world. Alienation is another thing that also follows from alienation from the self, actually, follows in the wake of trauma. So there's a, you know, there's a disorder, DPDR, that often results in someone feeling outside or detached from their body in the wake of trauma. And that turns out to be a kind of coping mechanism. On the other hand, art and beauty seem to have a healing and reintegrating effect for trauma victims. So my wife and I have a friend who I'll call Jane, and Jane has experienced brutal assault through her childhood and adolescence, such that the image of violent men, and the image of men in general, sort of bore this taint of her abusers. So whenever she approached the Old Testament narratives of violence, like the end of Judges, she'd feel trauma and traumatic memories welling to the surface. So she couldn't read it without re-experiencing trauma. So my wife, in her brilliance, in the process of discipling her, actually turned to a form of art therapy. She had Jane draw images articulating, in the words of paint and brushstrokes, her own traumatic feelings rising up upon reading the Old Testament. And Jane produced some of the most beautiful art of Judges I've seen. So she narrated her own experience of sexual assault through the account at the end of Judges, and found an expression of her own trauma in Scripture, and then found she was able to read Scripture as a way of re-narrating her own story. So there's precedent for this in the psychological literature. The wonder of art consists in part in its particular ability to re-narrate our lives. Art therapy is often used to give language to the pains and fragmentations trauma leaves on the soul, gathering up the fragments into an artistic image and bringing some sort of internal coherence. In art, one finds the possibility of a gestalt, which is an organizing form, through which they might reimagine and re-narrate their own past. For instance, I might find in Van Gogh's Starry Night a kind of language in which I feel my own sense of wonder in the world portrayed in a visceral way. The painting gives expression to an emotion deep inside, which may have been previously unexpressed. I might find in the turbulent brushstrokes of a particular painting an externalization of turmoil in my own soul, and thereby come to understand through an external image something of my own emotional landscape. Art, through the gift of image, gives the imagination more tools by which we might understand the movements of our own souls. You find this medicine, this medicinal effect of beauty, even delivered through music therapy. That's given language to countless people. Charles Taylor writes this about Mozart's minor quintet. The Mozart G minor quintet gives us a powerful sense of being moved by something profound and archetypical, not trivial and passing, which is both immensely sad, but also beautiful, moving, and arresting. We can imagine being moved in some analogous kind of way by some beautiful story of star-crossed love, of loss or parting, but the story isn't there. We have something like the essence of the response without the story. So the beauty inscribed in Mozart's quintet is a sort of language. It's a sort of story being told in musical image. This is why I think we enjoy movies with particularly fitting musical scores. So Ludwig Göransson's score, Can You Hear the Music, in Oppenheimer comes to mind, enhances the movie by expressing the story of the film in language, in sort of aesthetic language. Now, beauty's healing power, I think, lies in the latent power of beauty to re-narrate the wonder of a life. Our sense of selfhood is largely constituted by narratives that we imagine to be ourselves to be inhabiting. If some incredible illness or trauma casts its shadow over my world, I start to see sunlight's hues dimmed by the shadow. My life is lived in a horizon that's constrained by trauma. So whenever someone undergoes extreme trauma, it threatens to say that the world is like this. It threatens to uproot the stories we tell ourselves, to constrain them, to twist them, to put a damper on them. But beauty comes like a herald of good news in the midst of a traumatic exile. So the laughter of a child cues us towards believing that the world, despite its ugliness and horror, is perhaps embedded in a narrative in which beauty bursts to break through. The beauty of a fairy story, for instance, lies in its capacity to deliver what, of course, Tolkien calls a eucatastrophe. The best fairy stories are glimpses of a joy beyond the walls of the world, as poignant as grief, in Tolkien's words. That's why I think fairy stories and discussions of beauty so often go together. The latter is a narrative vehicle of the former. Or rather, the former is a narrative vehicle of the latter. Fairy stories are a narrative vehicle of beauty, which similarly bespeaks of some joy beyond the walls of the world. Why is this? Well, I take it that if beauty is really the appearing, the sort of gravitas of triune love in the world, then it makes sense that it starts to bring some sort of internal coherence to our lives. Because we start to see the kind of story emanating from the triune God in which we might be able to find our lives. In other words, in the appearance of the triune God in beauty, in his felt gravitas, which is experienced as love, we start to taste a narrative in which we can actually find internal coherence, which makes sense of our lives. Beauty, this is the last feature I'll cover. Beauty has this, well, we'll cover two more features, okay. Beauty has this unity with goodness, right? So, you know, Emerson, he writes the following. Beauty is the mark God sets upon virtue. Every natural action is graceful. Every heroic act is also decent and causes the place and the bystander to shine. The winds and waves, said Gibbon, are always on the side of the ablest navigators. So are the sun and moon and all the stars of heaven. When a noble act is done, perchance in a scene of great natural beauty, when Leonidas and his 300 martyrs consume one day in dying, and the sun and moon come each and look at them once in the steep defile of Thermopylae, when Arnold Winkelried, in the high Alps under the shadow of the avalanche, gathers in his side a sheaf of Austrian spears to break the line for his comrades, are not these heroes entitled to add the beauty of the scene to the beauty of the deed? So here's a singular fact about beauty, is that it's united to goodness. Moral goodness signals itself by beauty. You know, Jonathan Edwards called virtue the beauty of the soul, and actually so did Aristotle, as it turns out. The language of beauty for Aristotle just gives way to the language of goodness, at least it seems to. For him, moral actions are for the sake of the beautiful, such that it is for the sake of the beauty, the beautiful, towards which virtue is directed. So virtue is pursued for Aristotle, that lives might exhibit beauty. Okay. You find this sort of connection between beauty and goodness in Plotinus. You find this in 20th century writers like Hans Urs von Balthasar, who writes, in a world without beauty, in a world which is perhaps not wholly without beauty, but which can no longer see it or reckon with it, in such a world the good also loses its attractiveness, the self-evidence of why it might be carried out. So Plotinus calls beauty the porch of the good. It's sort of the means by which goodness draws things to itself. And Balthasar says, beauty is the self-evidence of why goodness should be carried out. It's the attractiveness of goodness, the draw of goodness. And that's really interesting. And it has this tight unity with goodness, which again, makes sense. If beauty is the sort of gravitas, the pull of triune love in the world, the triune being of God is this organic principle of unity between beauty and goodness. And lastly, this is such an interesting experience of beauty, or an interesting observation about beauty. That beauty engenders love in the soul. We've covered the fact that Plato thinks this. Plotinus thinks that love is concerned with pure beauty as its object. And Augustine thinks that beauty is the attractive force uniting us to those things we love most deeply. I mean, think about this. So the most fitting language Shakespeare can use to describe his beloved is the language of a Midsummer's Eve, right? Emerson, he writes the following. The lover cannot paint his maiden to his fancy, poor and solitary. like a tree and flower, so much soft, budding, and forming loveliness as a society for itself. And she teaches his eye why beauty was ever painted with loves and graces attending her steps. Her existence makes the world rich. The lover sees no resemblance except to summer evenings and diamond mornings, to rainbows and song of birds. So roses are a fitting crown, bedecking your spouse's hair, and the cool, crisp air of the forest is the frame sweetening memories of walks with your dearest friends. So my companions, my friends, they light up my world, right? They add a hue to my world. Now, why is there this strong kinship between beauty and love? Dietrich von Hildebrand once argued that love is a response to the beauty of the beloved. Love is a perception not only of the realized beauty of its object, but includes elements of faith and hope insofar as it sees the potential beauty of its object as well. Love is fundamentally, for von Hildebrand, an affective aesthetic response. It's a response to beauty. Now, why would he think this? Well, when I love a dear friend, for instance, saying I long for their good, right? Aquinas talks about love as the willing of the good for your beloved. Then I desire the good of my beloved friend, and I want to see them caught up in an overall life story, which brings out their best and the best for them. But since love is particular, it's not just general. That means I must imagine a particular kind of beauty of the beloved. And so I might buy one friend a book, another friend a grill, right? In accordance with the joys and goods that bring out beauty in them. So I want to submit to you, beauty in its wake engenders love in the human heart, right? The experience of beauty engenders particular love, right? So if you see particular beauty in your friend, that engenders and evokes a way to love them particularly. And I want to suggest that it's because the reason beauty leaves love in its wake is because the triune God, when he draws things into himself, into his own life, leaves love in his wake. That is the core of deification. So the Trinity completely reframes, I think, our experience of beauty. Tell me what you think in the comments. I find the world so much richer viewing my experience of beauty as this sort of entrance, this pull into the triune life of God, this glimpse of the dynamics of triune love. I think that's right. Let me know what you think in the comments. And I hope this video is helpful to your own reflection, meditation on the wonder of the Trinity. God bless.